You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Protests erupted across the globe in late 2007 when the cost of food soared, leaving more people hungry than at any other time in history. Although prices have fallen since, food security remains a challenge as crops face extreme weather like the drought of the past summer. As the world population continues to grow, Lester Brown, the president of the Earth Policy Institute, warns that food will be the new oil and land the new gold. In his most recent book, Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity, he describes the trends that make this so. It is published by Norton, and I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show. Hello.
Delighted.
Analysts predicted that 2012 would see the largest corn harvest in history. How did the actual harvest compare with the expectations?
Well, in this country, it's down by about 35%, which is huge given the fact that the U.S. corn crop is the largest grain crop of any country in the world. Corn is now the world's leading grain. It used to be wheat and rice, but corn has moved 20% ahead of wheat now, and it's double the world rice harvest. And this is because so many people in the world are moving up the food chain, consuming more grain-intensive livestock products. So the demand for corn is increasing at an extraordinary rate.
Do you see long-term repercussions for this summer's drought?
Yes. This drought we've seen this summer, drought and intense heat, is not just a standalone event. It's part of a process that we call climate change. And what we forget is that agriculture as it exists today has evolved over an 11,000-year period of rather remarkable climate stability. And now suddenly the climate system is changing. So with each passing year, the agricultural system and the climate system are more and more out of sync with each other.
But this seems to be fairly recent. You call the 50 years from 1950 to 2000 one of the most food secure in world history, with even worries of overproduction. So what happened? Wasn't climate change already in the works?
It was in the works, but not yet having much measurable effect. The period from 1950 to 2000 was an extraordinary period in the growth in world food production, world grain production generally. But since the turn of the century, we've had more and more trouble keeping up, and this is why we've seen corn and wheat and soybean prices double the historical levels.
Is there consensus in the agricultural community that climate change will increase this kind of crop loss?
There may be more of a consensus in the meteorological community that this will be the case. Most of the people who do projections in agriculture are agricultural economists, and they're not really very sensitive to climate change or to the depletion of aquifers and so forth. These are fields outside their field of training.
So, even though it's so important to their field.
That's right. But it's one of the problems of specialization that we face in the world. I don't think there's any question but that climate change is going to shape our futures. It's going to alter our diets. It's going to affect population distribution. It's going to translate into political instability. I think the term food unrest is going to become part of our working vocabulary.
And you say we're moving into a new food era, but why won't demand push new technologies that help us find better ways to grow food as it has in the past?
One of the difficulties is that we have done almost everything we can think of to raise crop yields. People look at genetic modification and say, wow, look at all the possibilities here. Well, there's some things you can do with genetic modification, like breeding cotton varieties that are resistant to the cotton boll weevil, so you don't have to use insecticides anymore. Those sort of things you can do. But with conventional plant breeding, we had already done almost everything we could think of to do to raise yields.
And not everybody's happy with the whole concept of GMO, just simply on a nutritional or a health level.
Right. But whether you're happy with it or not, it's not going to increase yields. That's sort of the bottom line.
What are we talking about? How much of a change has there been? How many people were hungry globally in the late 90s, and how many are hungry today?
The number has increased over the last few decades from, say, 700 million to roughly a billion. And much of that is concentrated in two regions, sub-Saharan Africa and the Indian subcontinent, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh.
And we're told that children are most affected by that.
Children are most affected, and we're seeing something new now. I mean, the reason children are most affected is because they need food both to maintain daily activity, but also to grow and develop healthy bodies and minds. And in many cases, they're not getting it now.
On the other hand, aren't there concerns about an obesity epidemic in this country?
The irony is that, and not only in this country, in cities in the developing countries as well. So we have this situation where part of the world is suffering from too many calories and part of the world from too few calories. And it turns out that those groups are roughly the same size. Of the world population of 7 billion, there are about a billion on the lower end who are undernourished and a billion on the upper end that are over-consuming.
My guest is Lester R. Brown, who is president of the Earth Policy Institute. His latest book, Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. And you say that food is the new oil. In what sense?
For the last several decades, importing countries have always been a bit insecure and uneasy about where their future oil supply would come from, partly because so much of it comes from the Middle East, which is increasingly unstable in a political sense. But we didn't worry about food. But now, with so many countries so heavily dependent on food imports, and with the demand growing so rapidly from population growth and rising affluence, access to supplies has suddenly become an important issue, and it has led to a new geopolitics of food scarcity.
What about food prices? Are they pretty much the same around the world?
Well, there's really only one world market for grain, for example, one world price for grain. So whether you live in New York or New Delhi, the cost of the wheat that you consume is essentially the same. The big difference.
How did that happen? Did Chicago just take over the world?
No, it's because, for one thing, the U.S. is the world's largest producer and exporter of grain. We totally dominate world grain exports. The Chicago Board of Trade actually, in the daily trading, sets the price for wheat and rice and soybeans. But it's also because the world food economy is an integrated economy today. Half century ago, each country had sort of its own food economy. But now everything is tied together, and grain moves in massive quantities around the world.
Globalization. But hasn't there been a move in recent years to become local again? Or is that just a tiny portion of the full agricultural picture?
Yeah. In the United States in particular, there has been an effort to develop local agriculture and to have local fresh food available. And though it gets a lot of attention and has a lot of support, I mean, it's led to close to 10,000 farmers markets in the United States today, where people can go and get food produced by farmers in their area, in their community. And that's good, but it probably accounts for 1% of the U.S. food market.
A common saying is that any society is only three meals away from anarchy. How much of the political instability we've seen in recent years can be traced to food shortages rather than to religious fervor or some of the other things that we generally associate with them?
It's difficult to separate out these factors. We know in the Arab Spring there was resistance to autocratic forms of government. We know that there was a sense that the people at the top were doing very well and the rest were not doing well. And also concern about rising food prices. So we had a number of social and political trends converging at this point in time. And it was sort of ignited when the street vendor in Tunisia who sold vegetables and who was forced to bribe officials to keep a stand open finally reached the point where he had enough and he just set himself on fire. And that really expressed the frustration of a lot of people, particularly young people in the Arab world. And it certainly contributed to, and it obviously triggered the what we now call the Arab Spring.
You say that the rise in food prices and hunger will eventually bring down our social system. Well, haven't we been hearing something similar since Malthus wrote about that in the late 18th century?
We have been.
Didn't happen then, and it was kind of like treated, it's been treated historically as a kind of a Chicken Little thing.
Yes. And in the past, that's been the case. But at the same time, we've had now for some time a billion hungry people in the world, people who are hungry and malnourished. And those of us who read Malthus and know about Malthus are not part of that billion. If you talk with those who are members of that billion, you'll see that they think they're there already. I mean, they're struggling, many of them, just to survive.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about some of the trends that Lester Brown sees as being important in understanding this topic, the topic being the subject of his book, Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. It's published by W.W. Norton. Stay with us. We are back with Lester Brown, the president of the Earth Policy Institute, whose latest book is Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. It's published by Norton. John left this comment on our show page, a listener. I'd be most interested in knowing how cutting off food imports to the United States would affect the United States and those exporting nations. Who would suffer more? Would we benefit or those nations, or would this just not really fix the problem?
Sure, so the exports from
other countries, I guess, to us, because there is this export imbalance.
Well, we import in value terms a surprising quantity of foods. I mean, all the bananas we consume in this country are imported from Central America, for example, or coffee or tea, the beverages.
And then during the winter, a lot of fruits come from South America.
And
a lot
Caribbean,
of stuff comes from Mexico.
Yep.
China now?
Our strength is grain production, and we totally dominate world grain trade. So in terms of surviving, we're in good shape. But in terms of having an interesting diversified diet, we're heavily dependent on imports. Some of the new trends are of particular interest. One is China's emergence as a massive importer of soybeans. China gave the world the soybean, but 60% of all the soybeans that enter international trade now go to China, because when you move up the food chain, you need a lot of soybean meal to mix with the grain to get efficient conversion of grain into animal protein. Largely as a result of this huge demand for soybeans, imported soybeans in China, soybeans have now become the leading crop in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, I can remember as a youngster in southern New Jersey 60 years ago driving down the road and seeing a field of soybeans. We'd stop the car and get out and look at it. It was a curiosity. And now we have more land in soybeans in the Western Hemisphere than either wheat or corn.
And I always thought it was because people like soy sauce.
Soy sauce probably accounts
Japan and China.
For 1% of soybean use. Food use broadly, including tofu and other things, at most 10% of the world's soybean harvest. The big consumption is the animal protein produced with soybean meal.
What does a food-scarce United States look like?
You know, it's almost hard to imagine, because from the beginning we've had this abundance of food. What we don't most of us realize is that if ever there was some disruption in the movement of food in this country, we could find ourselves with huge cities entirely dependent on imports in trouble. For example, what if there's some very virulent strain of the flu broke out and truck drivers didn't want to go out because they might expose their children to a potentially deadly disease? The food supply in the typical city in the United States, like New York, is at most 3 days of consumption. It's constantly fed by new arrivals. And if that's ever disrupted, things could unravel pretty fast, and we would discover what food scarcity really is.
These days, what percentage of our income in this country is spent on food?
It's very low. It's 10% or so.
How does that compare with the rest of the world?
In the developing world, it's between 50 and 70%. So if the price of wheat doubles for us, I mean, there's only 10 cents worth of wheat in a loaf of bread anyhow. And so if it doubles, it adds another 10 cents. So the loaf, instead of costing $3, costs $3.10. I mean, it's marginal. We might complain about it, but it's not life-threatening. But if you live in New Delhi and you go to the market and buy wheat and bring it home and grind it up to make chapatis, if the world price of wheat doubles, the price of your chapatis double. And that's the difference. Low-income people feel very directly these increases in world prices. We're greatly isolated from them.
We keep a lot of grain in reserves. Do we keep enough?
We used to, but not anymore. As the world's leading exporter, the U.S. used to, as a service to the world, sort of maintain substantial stocks. It used to be, say, 15 years ago, that we had about 110 days of consumption in stocks. We call them carryover stocks. That's the amount in the bin when the new harvest starts to come in. It's kind of a margin of safety. But that 110 days of consumption is now down to 75 days and dropping.
Why is that?
Because we're consuming faster than we produce.
And so then we have the drought.
Right. So the drought forces us to draw down stocks even further.
This sounds like the same sort of thing we've seen with oil. You have compared the situation with oil. But also you say land is a key factor in the story. Land is gold.
In 2007, 2008, when world grain prices doubled, we had some poor harvests and so forth. And importing countries looking for grain suddenly realized that there wasn't enough to go around, and there was no place for them to go, and they panicked, and rightly so. They had always depended on the market, but suddenly exporting countries like Russia and Argentina, leading wheat exporters, banned exports because they wanted to keep their domestic food prices down, which means that prices in the rest of the world went up even faster. So that's when importing countries panicked and realized that they needed to get some land on which to grow food for themselves that they could control. So we have this enormous flurry of land grabs with importing countries trying to buy land in other countries. And it's become such a profitable issue that agribusiness firms now are trying to buy land in Africa or Latin America on which to grow food for export. Investment banks are investing in this. Even university endowments are investing in land funds because the value of land is going up about twice as fast as the Dow Jones Industrial Average.
And a country like Saudi Arabia is deeply involved in this because they can't grow much in Saudi Arabia.
The Saudis were self-sufficient in wheat for about 30 years, but they were pumping from a fossil aquifer. That is an aquifer that does not recharge. So when they emptied that aquifer, that was basically the end of it for them. And suddenly, almost overnight, they became totally dependent on wheat imports. But they, too, were feeling uncertain, even with their purchasing power. So they started buying land big time in other countries.
Well, we're seeing other countries going through similar problems with their aquifers, the United States being one of them, India, which is a major agricultural country. Are we going to see land grabs increasing? Many of the African countries where this land is being bought or leased rely on food aid. Why don't they just simply develop the land themselves?
It's sort of a political situation where they don't have the internal resources to make the investments. And so they just lease the land to agribusiness firms from abroad who do have the capital to work with.
Do they get to eat any of the stuff that's grown in their own country?
In many cases, they don't. It's grown by investors from abroad who control the production, and it's intended for markets back home or for the world market.
So how have these acquisitions from land grabs affected the locals? What's been their response? Is this the sort of thing we're seeing in Nigeria with oil?
In country after country, the governments, the national governments, are selling big chunks of land on which villagers live and which they've lived for generations and on which they depend for their food supply, and they're just being pushed off. I mean, it's an example of how the bottom echelons of in terms of income are losing to the few percent at the top who are making these agribusiness investments. It's a redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top.
So is farmland becoming a more popular investment these days? In the past, farmers were selling off their land to people who want to build housing developments.
The value of farmland is going up very fast, including here in the United States. It's not as widespread here as it is in many countries, but there are foreign investors buying farms in the U.S. They're not buying; they can't buy huge blocks of land, but they can buy farm by farm, and that's happening because land values are going up so much, and because we have such productive cropland.
My guest is Lester R. Brown. His latest book is called Full Planet, Empty Plates: The New Geopolitics of Food Security. It is published by W.W. Norton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You divide your book into the main trends that threaten food production. Is overpopulation more of a threat than climate change?
It's hard to separate the two because they're reinforcing each other in threatening food security. We've been adding 80 million people a year for the last few decades now. That means that tonight there will be 219,000 people at the dinner table who were not there last night. Tonight there will be another 219,000. And that's a relentless increase in pressure on land and water resources. And good weather or bad, it just sort of continues. So we need to think seriously about the population problem and think about getting family planning services to the millions of women in the world who want to plan their families but don't have access to family planning services. That's number one. The climate threat is real and probably far more serious than we recognize. And the key to that is cutting carbon emissions. And that really is going to take something like a World War II mobilization to restructure the world energy economy, shifting from coal and oil and natural gas to wind and solar and geothermal.
Well, you have geopolitics in your subtitle, but in the case of the United States, it is local politics. Congress still, many people in Congress still do not accept even the concept of climate change.
That's true.
And they're the ones who make the policies.
That's true. What we did notice in this past summer, though, with the heat and drought sort of overwhelming the system and becoming such a focal point of attention, I mean, I got the feeling after a while that news channels were becoming weather channels. You know, it was there all the time. But you didn't hear the climate deniers jumping up and down during the heat and the drought saying, oh, this is just a temporary thing.
Well, George Will said it was the reason for it was summer.
That's true. But we're going to have more summers like that, and that's the problem.
Now, if overpopulation is a problem, why are governments in Western Europe concerned about declining birth rates?
Well, what's happening there, and we're seeing some of it here, is when population growth rates decline, you suddenly find the number of young people coming into the labor force shrinking at a time when the number of people who are retiring is increasing, still increasing. And so you have a smaller workforce base supporting a larger retired community. So that's going to require some rethinking. And one of the obvious things is to make the age of retirement more flexible. If you delay retirement because you want to keep working, as many people do at age 65 now or whatever the retirement age is, then we can begin to deal with the with the problem of over-dependence on a smaller workforce.
You talked about how corn and soy are really connected to people moving up the food chain, especially as a way of converting grain into meat, milk, and eggs. But corn has also been a major source of biofuel. What caused the surge in the production of biofuels in the United States in the early 2000s?
After Katrina, when a number of refineries, oil refineries in the Gulf area were disrupted for some weeks or even months by damage from the storm, the price of gasoline went up to, I think it was $3 a gallon. We had never seen $3 a gallon gasoline before.
Now it's over $4 in New York.
Right. But the price of corn did not go up at that time. So you had cheap corn, and you could convert it into ethanol to fuel cars. So economically, it was very attractive then. Now, with corn prices having tripled or so, it's not so attractive anymore. So we're not seeing any growth in ethanol production. In fact, in this country, ethanol production has dropped by close to 10% over the past year.
American meat consumption peaked in 2007, now is in something of a decline. Was that anticipated?
It was not anticipated because it had been going up for a half a century, and it was sort of expected it would continue to go up. But we have some trends converging here. We have a cultural shift in that young people are not so meat-oriented as earlier generations were. We have an economic influence here with grain and meat prices rising, so people, to balance their household budgets, cut back on the amount of meat they consume. And then there's, in addition to the economic and cultural thing, there's the politics of this and whether we can somehow in this country keep cheap food on the menu, and it's not clear that we can.
So here we are in what you're describing as a major crisis situation, and you're saying that although we have increased the yield per acre during the 20th century, that's a trend that we can't expect to continue. Where do we go from here? There's climate change, which affects photosynthesis, doesn't it? Is that a positive or a negative thing?
As the temperature rises beyond 95 degrees, it begins to reduce the rate of photosynthesis. And when you get to 104 degrees, photosynthesis ceases entirely. So there's no growth at all when you reach those temperature levels. So you don't need too many days over 100 degrees during the summer to begin to affect crop prospects. And that's the risk that we face.
A listener, Anderson, who is originally from Brazil, says the government there passed a law that's set to go into effect that would prevent foreign investors from buying land in the rainforest in order to turn it into farmland, which had been happening for years. But, of course, it hasn't stopped the buying of tropical forests by Brazilians to create farmland. And people are concerned about the loss of the Amazon. On the other hand, people in Brazil are saying, well, how can you be critical of us? We have to feed our people.
Well, much of the clearing of rainforest in the Amazon is not to feed Brazilians. It's to produce soybeans for export to China and other countries. And because we're not very good at raising soybean yields, for example, corn yields have quadrupled since 1940. Soybean yields have scarcely doubled. So we have to plant more soybeans to get more soybeans. And with this extraordinary growth in the demand for soybeans as people move up the food chain, we've got to have more land someplace, and that's where it's coming from.
You suggest that we need to reconsider our 20th century definition of national security to include food?
Yes. Our definition of national security today is largely shaped by the 20th century, which was dominated by two world wars and a Cold War. But if I sit down today with a clean pad and ask myself, what are the threats to our security in the 21st century, ours in a global sense? Armed aggression is not near the top of the list. Climate change, population growth, water shortages, rising food prices, growing food instability, growing political instability because of food. These are the issues that are threatening our security and indeed that of people everywhere. But we haven't made that mindset shift. We're still spending on military things as though advanced weapon systems were somehow going to save us.
And you use President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's World War II production goals as a precedent for how we can combat climate change and food scarcity. Sounds great, except I doubt that there are many people in this country who would support that. Judging from what I'm hearing in the debate during this election campaign, there are a lot of Americans and, of course, a lot of politicians who would say just the opposite.
We cross these tipping points very quickly sometimes. Roosevelt, in his State of the Union address, January 6, 1942, after a month after Pearl Harbor, said, we've got to produce 45,000 tanks, 60,000 planes, and he went down the list. I mean, it was an extraordinary thing. We were still a depression-mode economy at that point. People didn't see how it could be done. What they didn't realize was that he was going to ban the sale of new automobiles. So the automobile industry had to start producing tanks and planes. And we exceeded every one of those arms production goals.
So are you suggesting we ban the growing of soy and corn in such large quantities?
We may have to, not ban their production, but begin to look at the supply-demand balance at a global level in a way that we haven't before. Because before, it's always been possible to see a lot of growth potential in the future. We can't see so much growth potential now. In a number of agriculturally advanced countries, Japan, countries in Europe, yields have plateaued because they've sort of hit the glass ceiling. They've realized the full potential of raising rice yields in Japan or wheat yields in France, for example.
Lester Brown is the president of the Earth Policy Institute. His latest book is Full Planet, Empty Plates, The New Geopolitics of Food Scarcity. It's published by Norton. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Hunter, it's been a delight. We'll be right back.